As most of you know, we have had a series of discussions at the Miller Center on the history and development of rhetoric. These began the discussions with an examination of rhetoric in Greek times, Roman times, medieval times, so on. Then we addressed specific problems such as the rhetoric of public diplomacy. Our colleague David Clinton did a little book on the rhetoric of the national interest, and there are about 17 volumes which have been published in this series. But we reached the culmination and really the purpose for the Miller Center of this discussion, these discussions, in a discussion of presidential rhetoric. And we will have on October 3rd a discussion on the rhetoric of Ronald Reagan by Tom Griscom, who wrote the Moscow speech. And then one of Professor Ryan's friendly antagonists, I guess, Ted Wendt of the University of Pittsburgh, on the Kennedy rhetoric. So we're trying to pull together what has been approached through the foundations of rhetoric, bringing it to a head in discussions of presidential rhetoric. I was never quite so aware of how vital this had become as when listening to the discussions of some members of a group of a commission at Harvard on presidential press conferences. In that discussion, Richard Darman and others who served in the White House in the first term talked about the infinite care and attention that President Reagan gave to preparations for speeches, press conferences, and others. They said that in the briefings, aspects of the briefings he insisted and the preparations he insisted be done over and over again were the preparations for his presentation itself, apart from substance. That what really concerned him, and he insisted that he do these things, these presentations over and over again, was that, as he put it, I get it right. So rhetoric, style, format, all of these issues have come to the fore in the presidency, perhaps because of the media, but for other reasons beyond that, as I'm sure we'll hear. Halford Ross Ryan is professor of speech at Washington and Lee University. In a sense, he's returning to the University of Virginia because he was a visiting professor of speech at UVA. He was born in Anderson, Indiana. He has he received his bachelor's degree at Wabash College and his master's and PhD at the University of Illinois. He also has taught at Sweetbriar and at Wabash College. I took notes because the flood of publications that has resulted from his interest in rhetoric is quite astounding. And I'd like to read just a few of the titles. The title that occupies us most today is, of course, FDR's rhetoric and his publication, which has been very well reviewed and differentiated from other books on Roosevelt, is entitled Franklin D. Roosevelt's Rhetorical Presidency. However, he also has written and organized a presentation on American rhetoric from Roosevelt to Reagan, a collection of speeches and critical essays, which is in its second edition. He's edited with Bernard Duffy a book called The American Orators of the 20th Century, Critical Studies and Sources. He's prepared a volume on Oratorical Encounters, Selected Studies and Sources of 20th Century Political Accusations and Apologies. And in that volume, there are some fascinating essays which he himself has authored, including Nixon's Apology for the Fund, Prime Minister Stanley Baldwin versus King Edward VIII, and LBJ's Voting Right Address, and his relation to the Congress and the Congress's relation to LBJ on civil rights. Forthcoming are books on Harry Emerson Fosdick, Persuasive Preacher, which is to be published in 1989, and Henry Ward Beecher, Stump Preacher, a book forthcoming scheduled for 1990. So in every way, our neighbor to the West has been enormously productive and vigorous in his work in this field, and that's our good fortune, because as we begin to look at presidential rhetoric, it's a happy coincidence that a person who has done a great deal, perhaps most, on the subject is a professor at Washington and Lee. Delighted to have you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Thompson. I'm delighted to be here, and I only wish that my parents could be here, because listening to that wonderful introduction, my father would have just shaken his head. My mother would have believed every word of it. And I also met the gentleman next door to me, and come to find out he's a banker. And I'm going to be saying some things about the economic royalist, and come to find out I have one right here. I have a sense of what General Custer felt at the Little Bighorn, looking out at all of those Indians. I see all of you people gathered around, and I hope that you didn't bring your bows and arrows, because I'm going to say some nice things about Roosevelt. I'm also going to say some negative things about Roosevelt. Well, I've already, Mr. Thompson has already indicated to you what I'm doing now, so I guess I'll just get on with the Roosevelt part. I understand that there will be some question and answer, and I'll try to keep my remarks to about the 40-minute level, but being a person in speech and also a lecturer, and the way I like to conduct my courses, if you have any questions at any time, please feel free to interrupt me, and I'll try to answer them to the best I can, and I'll try to get back on track, but if you have questions, please feel free. The purpose of the book really was to examine FDR's rhetorical presidency, and there are some hidden things that I wanted to accomplish in it. I mentioned my friendly adversary, Theodore Wendt at Pittsburgh, and Wendt has been a forerunner in presidential rhetoric, and his thesis is that presidential rhetoric is basically to gain and maintain public opinion. Now, I don't find anything wrong in that, but the next sentence that he says, it's not a study in rhetoric or rhetorical style or criticism, it's just basically public opinion. And what I wanted to do in the book, sort of in, under, around, and through, was to suggest that rhetorical technique, that is persuasive ability, the art of rhetoric, does, as a matter of fact, gain and maintain presidential power, and that it is, as a matter of fact, a study of a rhetorical technique. And Ronald Reagan stands as a very good example of rhetorical technique, maybe not so much rhetoric, but the technique. So that was one of the things that I was trying to do. And so I accepted one of the important authors that you have here at the University of Virginia, is Caesar. Caesar and Tullis and Pacetti and Thoreau wrote an important article in Presidential Studies Quarterly, entitled The Rhetorical Presidency. And their basic thesis is that the president delivers rhetoric for two reasons. Number one, to move the people to elect him. And then number two, to move the people, to move the Congress to enact his agenda. And that, of course, is through programmatic speeches that the President of the United States addresses to the American people and to the Congress. And so that is basically the two things that I take in the book, the departure points for the book. The corollary of that, of course, is that, first of all, FDR practiced the art of rhetoric for success. He did it purposefully. He wanted to persuade people. And so looking at rhetoric, we can suggest how successful was he. And the second corollary that I tried to suggest is the idea of rhetorical revisionism. Now, it's not what if FDR had lived through the fourth term, or what if this or that and the other had accomplished. It's not that. What it is to suggest, if the critic is going to say that thus and so piece of speech was successful, and here's why, then the critic also, it seems to me, is compelled to say such and such a speech was not successful, and here's why I don't think it was successful. And then one needs to go the next step and suggest, well, it should have been done according to the art, if indeed it is an art, and suggest that it is, it should have been done this way, or it could have been more successful if it were done that way. Now, I realize that's argumentative, but on the other hand, it tries to make the next step. And I'm going to apply the rhetorical revisionism, particularly when I get to the court fight and when I get to the purge, so to give you an idea of where I want to go there. I started off the book with a chapter on persuasive delivery, and I did that purposefully. Generally, if delivery is treated at all, it's at the back of the book, and I wanted to put a chapter on persuasion at the beginning of the book, and the editors went along with me on that. The reason why, I think, is that FDR, finally get down to the beginning of talking about FDR, FDR's delivery was extremely persuasive, was extremely strong, and I think that's one of the aspects that impelled his rhetorical presidency. And without boring you with a lot of technical material, the fact of the matter is that I think that FDR's rhetoric was extremely useful. One of the things that I did just this summer, I received a grant from the Hoover Library Association to research Herbert Hoover's speech delivery. And I went to Long Branch and viewed Hoover's speeches, which are extant on the newsreel. And Herbert Hoover would put up a 75 or 80 page speech text, and that would go up on literally a music stand that was up here at eye level, because someone said that he generally wanted to deliver his speeches like this. So they put the speech text up there, and he would literally look out at the audience, and one by one, it must have been tedious for the audience to see him take these pages down, 80 pages, and he would just literally read the speech from that. No inflections. I never saw the man gesture once. He just stood there like this and delivered his speeches. Very little inflection, no dynamism, dour delivery. I think I have the evidence to suggest that his delivery just wasn't very compelling. Juxtapose that to FDR, the smile, the waved hand, the grin, the inflection, the dynamism. It was a comparison that anyone could see without difficulty at all. And so what I wanted to suggest there in the delivery was that, number one, FDR paid a lot of attention to his speeches. For instance, he would mark them out on how long they were going to go. He would underline for emphasis, and those things would be communicated when he actually delivered the speech. So he paid attention to those kinds of things in the speech invention process. The other thing that I did, which it's wrong to say it hasn't been done, but it hasn't been done to the extent that I did it, was I sat down in the FDR library and went through the White House public reaction files to the speeches. And let me tell you, that's boring and it's tedious and the dust gets in your eyes. And now and then you get some useful letters. Most of the letters are, gee, good luck, wonderful job, that kind of thing. But now and then one can get some substantive comments from Americans reacting specifically to Roosevelt's rhetorical technique, his delivery, and I utilize those whenever I can. You have to spend about a half an hour to get one useful one, but then once you have that, why then it suggests something that Americans did, as a matter of fact, react positively to his delivery. The next thing I went into was the FDR and the media, and I suspect that that's probably fairly straightforward. Obviously, Roosevelt was not the first to utilize the radio, but here again, the radio was very effective for reaching the mass audience, and he had a wonderful radio voice. Hoover didn't, for instance. The press conferences, I talk about those, as one would expect. But what he did try to do, and no one has really paid much attention to this, is the newsreels. And I try to suggest that rhetorical critics, presidential critics, ought to utilize the newsreels. Now, admittedly, there's not very much on the newsreels. But Americans at the time didn't know that. And when you were sitting in a movie theater and FDR came on the newsreel, and you weren't able to go down to listen to a speech, you saw FDR there. And I had this one wonderful quotation that said that new dealers, when they learned FDR was going to be on the New Deal, they would go down to the movie house to cheer FDR, and the Republicans would go down to hiss FDR. What I'm trying to suggest is the newsreels were your equivalent generation, as it were, of the television, and you saw FDR enacting his speeches, enacting his presidency, and so I tried to pay closer attention to those, and as a matter of fact, some early critics in the 1930s understood very well what the newsreel did. One quotation said that it's not really so important what you say, it's the people evaluate what's seen, and notice that seen first, and heard. And I suppose that runs counter to academics who want to, you know, pay attention to the grist of the rhetoric, but the fact of it is that people react to those visual cues as much as they do other things. The other thing that I found in the media was the scapegoat technique that FDR liked to utilize. He was actually pretty good at it. And what it was useful to do, he wasn't the first to do it, and neither is he the last to do it, but what he utilized was the news media as the scapegoat. When things weren't going well, particularly for the purge and the court fight, he would, to use a term from Richard Nixon, he would kick around the news media, which would divert attention from the problems that he had and transfer them over to the scapegoat, the Tory press, you know, with that nice aristocratic metaphor, and then people would start paying attention to the scapegoat of the Tory press, and they would not pay so close attention, at least if the scapegoat were successful, to his own device. And I guess in our own generation, the Nixon-Agnews situation, in a speech in 1969 attacking the news media is the best example of that, but Carter and Ford and Reagan have utilized it too, so it's nothing new. I just point out the fact that he utilized it. I then had the next chapter I have is on four campaigns to the people, and I utilized a book, Presidential Campaigns, Tactics and Strategies by Miles Martell, who was early in the Reagan administration, and he isolated that there were four basic stances that candidates take, either candidate or president, incoming presidents: attack, defense, ignore, me too, me better. And these serve very well to talk about the four campaigns, and I found some very interesting things. The first campaign, of course, Roosevelt was in a basic situation of attack. Incumbents generally are cast into the role of defense. The attackers, the candidates who are not in office, can be the attacker. But it was very interesting about, if you look broadly at FDR's 1932 campaign, one got a very good idea of problems in the Hoover administration, but one did not have a very clear idea about Roosevelt's ideas or where the country ought to go. And basically what Roosevelt ran was a campaign by negation. I don't believe in this, I'm not for that, I'm not for this Hooverism, I'm not for that Hooverism, but it isn't very clear what he was for. And that was an opportunity that was afforded him by being out of office, wanting to get in office. Of course, Hoover then was cast into the role of defending his administration, which is exactly what Roosevelt wanted him to do. And it also gave Roosevelt some latitude. If he's not very specific, then you can't get the counterattacks from your opposition, and so it just waffled on lots of things. Tried to suggest that Roosevelt had a very important canvas, but there's a very interesting metaphor, you know, the forgotten man speech, a metaphor that everyone could identify with because almost everyone thought they were the forgotten man by the Hoover administration. Well, the Hoover administration had its famous metaphor that attacking Roosevelt, that Roosevelt's policies on balancing the budget and tariff and all of that stuff were a chameleon on plaid. If you think about that, you know, how can a chameleon react on a plaid? That's a very intellectual metaphor. but it's not a visceral metaphor like the Forgotten Man. And I, you know, I can much identify with the Forgotten Man, the chameleon on a plaid. Well, that's interesting, but that doesn't appeal to me, maybe being out of work right now. So Hoover utilized some interesting metaphors, but they just didn't sell as well as Roosevelt's did. Then, of course, the New Deal speech, the Commonwealth Club address, which was a nod to the business community, and then, of course, the Pittsburgh speech, where he said he's going to balance the budget, but, and then in 36 came to regret that he ever gave that speech, and Raymond Moldy went back, Rosenman went back and read it and said, Mr. President, you just might as well forget that you gave that speech. You can't defend yourself on that one at all. Well, those kinds of things, I guess, go on in any kind of a campaign. The question arises, interestingly enough, to get back to my Hoover thesis as an interesting aside, we know now, of course, that the campaign that Hoover lost, but Roosevelt certainly didn't act as if he knew that. I mean, he campaigned very vigorously, and Hoover didn't act as if the campaign were closed, because Hoover came out of the pre-Rose Garden strategy and delivered a number of speeches across the country. And so Hoover campaigned well, too. So I think the point that we sort of miss in hindsight is both of these men did enact the rhetorical presidency, taking their campaigns directly to the people. Hoover wasn't originally going to do that. And then his advisor said, as a Supreme Court justice told him, Mr. President, remember that the American people do elect the president. Unfortunately, I suppose, for Hoover, but nevertheless, they do. Well, the second campaign was the beginning of a new campaign strategy that Roosevelt utilized, and he basically utilized it in his third and his fourth campaign. And I tried to identify it as an aggressive defense. And what Roosevelt did, again, you never mentioned Landon by name, ran against Hooverism. Hoover wasn't running, but it was effective to run against Hoover in 1936. Landon was never dignified. What was the kind of campaign that Roosevelt ran? Well, again, it was interesting. He waited for the Republicans to attack. The Republicans basically ran a two-pronged campaign. They ran an attack and Me Too, Me Better. Me Too, Me Better was that we will do everything that the New Deal is doing, but we will do it better. Well, that to Democrats is really not very persuasive at all, that the Republicans would do it better. And the attack, of course, wasn't very useful, because the New Deal seemed at that time to be solving the Depression. So what Roosevelt did was to wait until he was attacked by the Landon campaign, and then he would respond very vigorously to that. But that was a very astute campaign, because rather than going out and campaigning for things, which he could then say, to the Landon, here, attack me on this, he would wait and respond to specific attacks, and he would have a very good response to those, but he didn't have to defend, purely on the defensive, you see, those things that he didn't broach to begin with. So it was really a beautiful campaign strategy. And I would like to, I have some notes to myself, and here I haven't read them, but I do want to read the one thing to you. From his Syracuse speech, wanted to suggest to you how he did turn the tables. He said, let me warn you, and let me warn the nation against the smooth evasion which says, of course we believe in all these things. We believe in Social Security. We believe in work for the unemployed. We believe in saving homes. And then Roosevelt says, cross our hearts and hope to die. We believe in all these things. But we do not like the way the present administration is doing them. Just turn them over to us. We will do all of them. We will do more of them. We will do them better. And most of all, the doing of them will not cost anybody anything. Well, the absurdity, the running out to absurdity, that Republican campaign strategy, the people just howled with delight, and Roosevelt was running over the country saying those kinds of things. And it's not chicanery, it's not show business, it's the truth. Republicans, Me Too, Me Better, just wasn't going to work, and the attack really didn't work very well either. So the 36 campaign seems to me to be the most interesting, the most probably his best campaign, and of course he had the landslide there. The third campaign, I'm sorry, let me interrupt. This poem I found, and I want to read it to you. It was written about the time of the 36 campaign. I think you will appreciate it. It's entitled, "I'm So Tired of It All." I'm so tired, oh so tired, of the whole New Deal, of the juggler's smile, the barker's spiel, of mushy speech and loud bassoon, and tiredest all of the leader's croon. Tired of taxes on my ham and eggs, tired of payoffs to political yeggs, tired of Jim Farley's stamp on my mail, tired of my shirt with its tax-shortened tail. I'm tired of farmers goose-stepping to laws, of millions of itching job holders' paws, of fireside talks over commandeered mics, of passing more laws to stimulate strikes. I'm tired of the hourly increasing debt. I'm tired of promises still to be met, of eating and sleeping by government plan, of calmly forgetting the forgotten man. I'm tired of every new brain trust, of the ship of state, now a pleasure yacht. I'm tired of cheating the courts by stealth, and terribly tired of sharing my wealth. I'm tired of Eleanor on page one, of each royal in-law and favorite son. I'm tired of Sisty and Buzzy Doll. I'm tired, completely fed up with it all. I'm tired and bored with the whole New Deal, with its juggler's smile and its barker's spiel. Dear Lord, out of all thy available men, please grant us a Cleveland or Coolidge again. Well, Roosevelt knew there'd always be someone like that. In the third campaign, the strategy, tried to utilize the same strategy with Wendell Willkie. However, Willkie had one up on Landon. Willkie had a pretty good radio voice, and Willkie tried the basic strategy of attacking the New Deal. He tried to run the third term, that sort of dropped out. That really wasn't a particular issue. And so Willkie finally went for the troops are almost already on the transports to Europe. And then, of course, Roosevelt countered in the best way that a president could. And this, Dole found out, is trying to run against Vice President Bush. Dole made that comment that Bush drives up in the vice presidential limousine. Well, anyway, rather than going around and refuting Wendell Willkie's allegations, Roosevelt just got on the train and went to look at all the munitions factories up and down the East Coast, and these were on the newsreel, and here's the president looking at all the munitions, and that was a better communication than, oh, yes, I have done everything for the nation. I mean, there it is, looking at the airplanes, the tanks, the ships, and that one wasn't a very good campaign strategy from the Republicans. Here again, it was basically an aggressive defense, waiting for Willkie to attack and either respond verbally, as it were, or respond with these presidential images. Of course, the race was a little bit closer that time around. The fourth campaign, Dewey really was probably every bit as good in terms of his radio delivery, his radio presence as FDR, and I noted a lot of critics suggested that this was the first time that FDR really got a media, as we would use today, a media person who could meet FDR on his own ground. And FDR, I think, probably realized that and decided to campaign vigorously. Of course, the speech that immediately comes to mind is the Teamsters Union address. And I think the rhetorical beauty of the Teamsters Union address that people haven't realized is that Roosevelt needed to, the war was going on, people were getting tired of it, and he needed to invigorate the campaign with some kind of excitement. And what better way to do that than to interject humor into the campaign. And I noticed a couple of critics suggested that only Franklin Delano Roosevelt could utilize humor in a serious topic, in a serious campaign, and come off. And of course, here is Roosevelt's beauty. Who was the humorless man, the groom, on the wedding cake? You know, that metaphor that described Dewey, looked like the man, the little plastic man on the wedding cake. Dewey was rather humorless, and here's Roosevelt giving that speech. And what I tried to suggest was the rhetorical aspect is to invigorate some good old campaign rhetoric in a war-dreary world, interject that into the campaign. So the Teamsters Union speech obviously was the most important one. Of more substance was the issue of the United Nations. What was left over, of course, were the Wilkie Internationalists who were deciding whether to go sort of a swing vote, as it were. Are we going to go with Roosevelt? Are we going to go with Dewey? And this was a Dewey miffed a beautiful opportunity on the United Nations issue. The question Senator Ball and the internationalists were concerned about the United Nations. When the United States form, will we be able to give our forces to the United Nations under the control of the United Nations, or if there's a peacekeeping mission, are we going to have to go back to the Congress? I don't know what that might take. So what's the United States situation on that? Dewey, not wanting to alienate the isolationists in his own party, just glossed over. Roosevelt, in reminiscence of the garden hose analogy for Lend-Lease, suggested, he didn't say he would do this, but this is a metaphor, he said, well, you know, the police constable doesn't go down to the town hall to swear out a warrant for an arrest when he sees a criminal entering the house to commit a crime. Well, that doesn't say I'm going to. It doesn't say much of anything. But it suggests that he would be in support of that. And that was enough for Ball. That metaphor was enough for Ball, who then suggested, and Ulyas said, I will swing over for Roosevelt. So here again, tried to suggest that Roosevelt's command of the language in communicating that at a critical moment was useful for his campaign. So I think in overall, some of Roosevelt's best speeches were uttered in the crucible, the heat of the campaign to get himself elected, and I suspect those will be fine. Well, I moved on to the four inaugural addresses, and what I utilized there was an important essay published in a Presidential Studies Quarterly about inaugurating the presidency, and what these two people did, Kathleen Jameson from Texas, if you read Newsweek, she's often quoted about presidential rhetoric, and Carolyn Corse Campbell, who's the University of Minnesota. And they wrote this essay in Presidential Studies Quarterly and said that there are four elements that inhere in presidential inaugural addresses. And they are, first of all, the president always tries to reconstitute the people. We've had a divisive campaign, and in the inaugural address, we've got to bring the people together, so we reconstitute the people. Secondly, he rehearses communal values that are, you know, these American godmother and apple pie kind of thing that you are going to find in every presidential inaugural address. Thirdly, the president communicates the broad political principles which are going to inform his administration. Now, he's not going to get up and tell you every piece of legislation that he's going to do for the next 4 years, but he's going to give you those broad political principles which will govern him. And then fourthly, and this is fairly important, he needs to stress his power and limitations. Can't be perceived as a wimp. I have no powers whatsoever. Somewhat like Carter was perceived in his inaugural. You know, I really can't do anything. It's the people, that kind of thing. On the other hand, the president can say, we now have the imperial presidency. I'm the end-all, the be-all. So we have to walk a tightrope, to use that metaphor, of stressing my powers. But I also realize I have limitations. And then the fifth thing is that all of this is accomplished in epideictic rhetoric, which is a technical term that we in speech utilize to denote, well, it's a classical term, actually, ceremonial speeches that are given on ceremonial occasions. And I took to task their essay in the book on the four inaugurals, and I'm also down the road going to try to get together an edited book to really suggest that the theory isn't very useful at all. But that's down the road. That's a year or so. I have to put a prospectus together then. Well, anyway, let's get back to FDR's first inaugural address. My initial interest in FDR's inaugural address came by looking at his first inaugural. And no one had written anything, and I was just absolutely astounded. So anyway, I see my time's running out, so let me draw this up on the first inaugural. I found that he utilized three rhetorical techniques that make this an extremely interesting, persuasive speech, and probably one of the best speeches he ever delivered, and certainly the first or second best inaugural address that was ever delivered. And what he utilized, he isolated Moline, Louis Howe, and the other people who helped him write the speech. He isolated three important audiences in the United States. The first device that he utilized was the military metaphor. He had to stir up the people to assume that we were in a warlike situation. Why do you have to do that? If you read a speech, it's filled with military metaphors. Why do you want to do that? He needs to enlist the American people in a metaphorical battle against the Depression. Now, why do we want to use a battle? Well, in the military, you do what? You give up some of your freedoms, don't you? For the better good. And that's exactly what Roosevelt wanted the American people to do, because we're going to give up he knew that, at least. We're going to give up laissez-faire government. The government's going to start intervening in your lives. So we tell people that we've got to get them in the army to fight the Depression. Goes along that we'll therefore give up some of our freedoms that we had hitherto to fight the Depression. The second thing that he utilized was the scapegoat technique. Very interesting that in his campaign address, in the New Deal speech, he said, now some of us have to pay attention here and realize that we played the stock market and we're just as responsible for the Depression as everybody else. Now, you never tell the electorate, as Jimmy Carter did in the fell flat, you never tell the American electorate they're at fault for doing anything. They don't want to hear that. So what he did was to scapegoat the Wall Streeters, particularly the bankers. It's their fault, the reason we have the Depression. And of course, well, yeah, that makes sense, and we don't like rich people. An economic royalist friend here. Don't like rich people anyway. It's a very convenient scapegoat, you see. And they're responsible for that. And so what we're going to do is we're going to drive them from the temple, and then with the scapegoat driven away from the people, the American people, can now re-enter the temple. And Roosevelt even uses that as, we can now re-enter the temple. You see, we're cleansed of our sins, and who's responsible? The Wall Streeters. And then also note that the Wall Streeters are now going to be regulated, or at least we're going to tell the people we're going to regulate them. And then the last device that he utilized was the carrot and the stick device. Now, Roosevelt, when he fashioned his inaugural address, did not know he was going to be as successful as he was. So he utilized the carrot and the stick. He communicated to Congress that he wants, first of all, to work with them, okay, their experience in the legislation. But if the Congress is not forthcoming on these things, then he wants to go to the people and ask for the one remaining instrument, broad power to meet crisis. Okay, now the beauty of this is, If the Congress is not going to cooperate with him in the first instance, they're certainly not going to cooperate with him and give him broad executive power, right? But you don't think about that. Rather, what is the image of if the Congress doesn't cooperate, he's going to go to the people, which scares the Congress, as it were, rhetorically at least, persuasively, into cooperating with the president. Of course, this is a classic tenet of taking the presidency directly to the people. Well, I see I'm running out of time. I'm just going to skip over the rest of the inaugural addresses. They're all right. I want to move on to the Supreme Court fight, because here I might run into some trouble with some of you people, and I'm particularly interested in this. I developed a theory of accusation and apology, and my oratorical encounters book is about that. And what I try to suggest is that speeches of accusation motivate speeches of apology. All right? And I'm trying to look at the court fight from a rhetorical standpoint. Now, there are lots of caveats that I don't have time to list. I realize that lots of things were happening. But here's what I want to look at in the rhetorical of the court fight. And here's where the revisionism comes in. Suggests that Roosevelt, in his judiciary message, affirmed a bogus argument against the Supreme Court. Namely, it was overburdened and overworked and was too old. Okay? Now, That was not a very good accusation, and the press, the Republicans just sat back and said, we'll let the Democrats handle this one for us, which they did, and the conservative members of the Democrats took out against him. Okay, it became clear that the court was old, but that didn't necessarily mean that it was overworked or that it was necessarily conservative, and so that backfired. The old age overburdened argument just backfired. So then Roosevelt delivered two of his better speeches, the Victory Dinner Address and the Fireside Chat on the Judiciary. Now, what he did in the Victory Dinner Address was to forget the old age overburdened argument and finally come out with, the real problem with the Supreme Court is that conservative court is thwarting the Congress and the President's ability to treat a national oppression with national legislation. Okay, now that's what he ought to have, I argue, that's what he ought to have done in the very beginning, is to say that's what's happening. Now, what happened when he did that was that the conservatives said, see, we told you all along he didn't affirm the right issue in the first one, okay, which then raised more fears that there was something in, under, around, and through the scheme so that the people wouldn't be persuaded by it. And then in the Fireside Chat on the Judiciary, he sort of lapsed back into a little bit of the old age argument, and he also utilized the overburden, overwork. Now, what I try to suggest in my book is not that if he would have adopted my revisionism that he would have won the Supreme Court fight. I wouldn't be so foolish to do that. I do try to suggest, though, that from a rhetorical point of view, I think he would have been more successful because he would have preempted some of the accusations that he was given. Now, for proof of that, I used as an analog Chief Justice Charles Evans Hughes' letter to the Senate Judiciary Committee. And I found this to be a very interesting interrelationship between FDR's speech. Hughes met Roosevelt head-on and said the court is not now overburdened or overworked, and used statistical analysis to suggest, as a matter of fact, that they had heard more cases and disposed of more cases, although negatively they had disposed more cases than they had under the Hoover administration. So it was just patently false that they were overworked and overburdened. Hughes, on two occasions, specifically said, I do not address propositions of policy on what the court ought to take vis-a-vis the legislation. There, I think, is the proof for what I was trying to suggest. Hughes would have been cast into a role of defending the conservative court's interpretation, which he didn't want to do, but if Roosevelt would have said, look, we've got a conservative court here, and attacked that, Hughes would have been constrained in his responses. He would either have stay still, all right, or try to defend the conservatism. And of course, we now know in hindsight that he didn't want to bother defending conservatism because the court had changed in late December and he knew that they were going to rule favorably. But he didn't communicate that to Roosevelt. Roosevelt didn't know that. Okay, so I do try to suggest there. So the rhetorical revisionism suggests that Roosevelt didn't do it very well. He should have had a frontal attack. I also suggest just pass in about 5 seconds that Roosevelt should have broached the court idea in very vague general terms in terms of the political principles concept of some problems with the Supreme Court that I'm going to address in my administration. I try to argue that that would have preempted much of the surprise element that he has sprung on the country. Well, let me move over quickly. I'm running out of time here, but let me move over to the Purge. I have a chapter entitled The War of Words and Words of War. And what I try to argue on The Purge is another one of those rhetorical revisionism situations. It's also a classical example of the rhetorical presidency, of whether the rhetorical presidency doesn't work. And there were some real problems, I think, in The Purge from a conceptual point of view. The American people think it's all right for the president to get on the air and give programmatic speeches for national issues, but Roosevelt didn't appreciate the separation of powers doctrine, that it's an unwritten but seems to suggest that the president should not enter in picayune primary elections to decide what's happening. And then I utilized the theory of accusation, and again when he went to Georgia and I just have to put this in. Anyway, I read in the Atlanta Constitution, they had some things that some other people didn't have, and when Senator George, in 110 degree heat, was giving his speech against Roosevelt, they interjected some of these local comments, and when George was lambasting Roosevelt, somebody interrupted from the audience, heaving. Roosevelt, he's a listening up thar, you know, with that kind of accent. I can just envision Roosevelt just sitting there. He's a listening up thar to George, giving him all of these all these speeches. Well, anyway, FDR's only comment about Senator George was that deep down in his heart, he's not a New Deal liberal, you see. Well, what did that allow George to do in his response? Well, George brought up black baiting, labor unions, brought up all kinds of extraneous issues to the charge. It was very, very effective with the Georgia audience. And Senator George even said that Roosevelt never even spelled out a bill of particulars. And what I try to argue is that if Roosevelt would have attacked George and O'Connor and then these other people and Tidings, on a litmus test, the New Deal is the litmus test here, a policy. What's your stance on the New Deal? Not whether you're in your heart you're some kind of a liberal or some kind of a conservative, attacking your character, that he would have had a better success with that. Of course, the purge didn't work, and so suggested that it might not have worked, but he certainly could have done it much better than he did. Of course, at the purge time, we're also getting the Tory press, we're kicking them around. Also worrying about the economic rhetoric. Now, in the war rhetoric, can I go up until 12, and then I'll just stop at 12. Okay, I will stop at 12. You can get up and walk out if you want to. I said some nasty things about Theodore Wint at the beginning of my speech. Now I have to resurrect Theodore Wint. He wrote an absolutely brilliant article on presidential war crisis rhetoric. And he suggests three things that happen in presidential crisis rhetoric, and it's absolutely brilliant. And it happens every time. It's one of the best predictors of what happens in rhetoric that I know about. Anyway, suggests that the president comes on the air and suggests new facts that only the president knows. There are new facts which I am now communicating to you. Now, the beauty of this is we can't go check the facts. Only the president knows the facts, okay? The new facts then lead to a new situation over which only the President of the United States, as the Commander-in-Chief, has the ability to react. And so we have to react to this new situation. The third thing the President does is announce the policy. Oftentimes, the policy is announced ex post facto. For instance, Reagan, as I now speak, the bombs are falling. You say, well, very nice. It does what? It circumvents the democratic process of deciding whether we ought to be going to war. It also obviously circumvents the Congress's right to declare war. And then the last thing that the president does to ensure public support in the rhetorical presidency is he casts his language in devil angel, black-white dichotomies. They're all evil, we're all good. And these appeals are made so that he appeals to your manliness. You don't have any character, you're a wimp, you're somewhat unpatriotic if you don't support the president, okay? And this whole situation, Wint tries to suggest, is somewhat problematical, particularly on the new facts and the new situation. And what I wanted to suggest here, just very, very briefly, was the Greer episode in the Roosevelt administration, where at best, the Greer episode was manufactured. You'll remember that the Greer was fired upon by a Nazi submarine, but Roosevelt neglected to tell the fact that the submarine had been depth-charged by British airplanes and it had surfaced, as it were, to defend himself. So it was technically true that did happen, but it was certainly provoked. And the new facts, the new situation, the character, and all of that are all in that speech. Also, interestingly enough, I utilized that same format to criticize the war message. If you can remember what I said and go back and read the war message, it's all there. The Japanese, the dastards, you know, to shoot on sight, as it were. Well, the last chapter I have is writing the record, writing the rhetoric, which is really a kind of a tying up of the loose ends. I'm going to stop 5 minutes early.
Okay. Could I begin the discussion by asking about Luke Cammon's column yesterday? He, if you saw it, criticized Vice President Bush for doing what he said President Reagan never did in any of his campaigning, namely to impugn the patriotism of his opponent. In connection with the loyalty oath, Cannon, who, as you know, has certainly been as sympathetic to Reagan as anybody could be, and to Republican leadership generally, said that when you're on the tightrope situation, if you challenge the patriotism of your opponent, and he warned the vice president, therefore, to avoid that. A, is that, does that borne out in terms of peacetime situations? B, do wartime situations change that dramatically?
Well, I'm not going to answer your question directly, but I'll give you two examples that might suggest what Roosevelt actually did and then what someone else did. In the wartime situation, Roosevelt actually used this line in the 1940 campaign. He said, now, I'm not accusing these people who are the interventionists, the non-interventionists, the isolationists. I'm not accusing them of aiding and abetting the Nazi administration, but what they're doing is aiding and abetting the Nazi administration. And so, you know, I'm not going to mention in the court about my aunt who's sick, and if I have my car taken away from me, I won't be able to take it. You know, it's an affirmation by denial. And McCarthy utilized that very, very effectively. I'm not saying these people are communists, but if they were communists, they would be doing exactly what they are doing, and the inference is very clearly made. Roosevelt didn't attack the patriotism directly of people. I think he just had a more artful way of doing it. I guess that's one of the problems with this campaign, is it seems to be dirty. I think Roosevelt tried to run, quote, cleaner campaigns, I think.
Norman Graebner, you taught a course on Roosevelt when you were Harmsworth professor in England. Are there any issues that came up in your discussions there that you think we ought to pay attention to in this subject?
I certainly did dwell on the rhetoric of Roosevelt because it was so effective, and you can't deal with Roosevelt without that voice and the gestures and so on. But there's the other side of it that I would like to raise with you, namely the nature of the audience to which you're addressing. Now, you spoke largely of the person doing the speaking and his gestures and his so on, which are all extremely effective, and I listened to many of those speeches myself, and I have to admit they were unbelievably effective. But he is addressing audiences that are going to react so positively to that because there is a connection between what he is saying about economic royalists, for example, and the fact that 60 million people are unemployed and other millions holding on as best they can, so that there's an audience there that's going to react very positively to what he said. Now, for example, you talked about Hoover's lack of success and the lack of rhetoric. Now, until the Depression hit, Hoover went over very, very well. Mm. You see, in other words, what is changing in the decline of Hoover's rhetoric is not his sudden loss of ability, but the fact that his audience has changed. And I was getting stones thrown at him for the same speech that would have brought nothing but applause 2 years earlier. And so I'm wondering if you would comment on the relationship between the positive audience. After all, Reagan gets extremely positive results in his speeches, but usually before hand-picked audiences. See, there's always the connection between the audience and the speech. And having taught for 40 years, I know that you cannot stand before an audience successfully unless the audience is on your side.
Okay, well, let me respond. I think one of the things that I do in the book, I mean, you've raised a question, which is valid. One of the things I do specifically in the book, and for instance the fireside chats, those have always been utilized as a kind of a single issue fireside chat going before the nation. I try to argue that that wasn't the case. I try to argue that in the chats and in all of the speeches, Roosevelt, as a matter of fact, is addressing a multiplicity of audiences, very many audiences within the audience. And so when you find the fireside chat on the judiciary, for instance, you get the reference to what's going to happen in 1940 in that little veiled thing and all kinds of things. So I think your point is well taken. Roosevelt tried to address as many audiences as he could in those speeches, and they're covered in there. You got something for farm, you got something for labor, you have something for this or that and the other. Obviously, Roosevelt was not going to persuade the 16 million hardcore Republicans who voted for Landon, all right? But there were those Republicans who took a walk, and in the book I have a number of quotations from people who suggested that they, after listening to a speech, or for instance, one even says, I've been a Republican, I'm going to take a walk. I realize it's idiosyncratic, but I suggest it's probably reflective of what's going on. So, yes, he did have positive audiences. Yet, on the other hand, and I tried to argue this too, an author suggested that Roosevelt's speeches were to be seen and heard. Well, yes, that's true, but that's only true by half. He was also aware that more people were going to read them in the newspapers, for instance. And so the style and the appeals, the rhetorical appeals, were utilized for the reading audience as well. So, yes, your point's very well taken. It's difficult to conceptualize the American audience, but it's very well taken.
You never having spoken to a hostile audience, maybe you'd be very interested in the language. Do you have any questions, Professor Quah?
I was wondering whether presidential rhetoric has become increasingly important as the 20th century has gone on because of the development of the electronic and photographic media as compared with the 19th century when not many people could see a president or hear him in person. By contrast, it might appear that congressional rhetoric has become less important. We hear less about Daniel Webster's in the Senate these days than in the 19th century. Is it true that that we've had that contrasting set of trends, pair of trends?
Well, obviously, to a certain degree, yes. I mean, obviously, 19th century presidents didn't give as many programmatic speeches, if any at all, to the American people. And, of course, that's been facilitated by the rise of the media. I suppose the first so-called rhetorical president was either Theodore Roosevelt or Woodrow Wilson. And interestingly enough, we're getting early newsreels signed. A questionable claim about the rhetorical presidency that Caesar and Thoreau and Tullis and Pacetti make is that presidential communications to the people move the Congress. And this gets back to what you're talking about. I don't want to say that Reagan is not a successful presidential persuader, but if you look at it, did he really persuade the Congress to pass Reaganomics, or did he have a very favorable Congress to begin with? What I'm trying to suggest is, does he give rhetoric that just reinforces what everybody already elected him? Or if you don't like the Reagan example, let's talk about Roosevelt. I mean, he was elected by huge majorities, so in a sense, did he persuade people? And in two instances, the purge and the courts fight, he didn't. So your question about the importance of it, we in any age, we tend to think we have arrived, and I suspect that people sitting around talking about this, as it were, at this room in 1936, the importance of the newsreels and the radio, they would say, yes, I mean, geez, that's extremely important. I think the point that Roosevelt was trying to communicate, and I tried to communicate in the books, the people at the time reacted to those media much the same way we do. It's certainly different. But they thought it was important. He thought it was important. So that is, I think, the way I would respond to your question.
Other questions? David Clinton?
Could I follow up on both the previous questions by asking, is it any accident that your successful examples of Roosevelt's rhetoric, the campaigns, the inaugural addresses, the war messages, were all to mass audiences, and your unsuccessful examples, the court fight and the purge, were to smaller, more defined audiences, so that the nature of the audience, as well as the techniques that the speaker uses, determines the success that when you're talking to, when you're trying to persuade members of Congress who have their own sense of their own constitutional responsibilities, who have more information at their disposal than a mass audience, rhetoric as such is like less likely to be effective than when you're talking to a mass audience.
Well, I would sort of agree and disagree. If you take the speech in Georgia that he gave against Senator George, obviously that was a very localized speech to a constituent audience that really wasn't interested in what Roosevelt thought. They were interested in what their own senator, and as Rosenman said in his oral history, if the people of Georgia had read the platform of the Democratic Party, they would be amazed that George was constrained to vote for those things. Okay, so that's an example of your supporting situation. It seems to me, though, on the other hand, if you talk about the victory dinner address, which was broadcast to the nation on the victory dinner celebration, so it wasn't exactly a mass audience that was open, but it was broadcast to the nation, and of course it was carried in all the newspapers. So that was a kind of a mass audience. The problem with the rhetorical presidency there is what do people in Boise, Idaho, what are they going to do for the conservative Southerners, Democratic Southerners, whom they don't even elect, okay, who are fighting Roosevelt? They have no levers, powers whatsoever. So that's a problem in the application of the rhetorical presidency. Then if you take the fireside chat on the judiciary, which was a national audience, still trying to, you know, I mean, that's classical rhetorical presidency. Yet the problem in here is, what are all of the people of the United States, is a senator who's fighting Roosevelt, are they going to pay attention from letters from constituents all over the country? No. So it's a problem of the construct, it seems to me, more than the rhetoric, because the fireside chat on the judiciary and the victory dinner speeches, I think, are eloquent speeches, mass audience speeches, as it were. You might want to quibble with me there on that. I think I definitely have you there on the judiciary speech. But the Barnesville speech was not national, and the problem there is just didn't pay attention to separation of powers doctrine, I try to argue. Mm-hmm.
Next question, Professor Fernbaum. Let's try to have some who are not professors ask the questions, too.
I'll hold back if you want.
No.
I wondered if you might give us some idea of how the Division of Labor went in putting together a speech of Roosevelt's. Who were the speech writers? Who worked on substance? Who then said, now polish it up this way, and the clever phrase? And how much did FDR himself put in here in terms of rhetoric?
Okay, well, obviously it varied from time to time, so I have to respond generally. The equal among equals, the sort of the pivotal person, was Samuel Rosenman. And Samuel Rosenman, as you probably know, wrote a lot of the speeches. Stanley High, Richburg, Corcoran, Louis Howe, when he was alive. I mean, there's just lots of people contributed. Burrell, all kinds of people. The point I think that I would want to make here, and this, people in speech are very concerned about the fact that of ghostwriters, the man behind the throne, that idea. And to the extent that I could do it in my book without just saying I think people are silly, okay, here that's what I tried to do in the book, and suggest how I tried to do it, was that in Roosevelt's situation, and only in Roosevelt's situation, he had so gone over the drafts. I mean, I paid very close attention to quote them, you know, largely. He had gone over them, he had changed the style, he had practiced them, he had read often, he had to read them aloud, or at least to himself, because he had minutes ticked off and how long they had gone, that for all intents and purposes, they were Roosevelt's speeches. I try to make the argument, for instance, in the third inaugural address, that was basically his. It started out in his own handwriting, and he wasn't particularly eloquent. And the third inaugural address was kind of a so also ran speech, because basically it was Roosevelt's speech. On the other hand, the IC One Third of a Nation, that was Roosevelt's. We will gain the inevitable triumph, so help us God. I mean, that the rhythm of that is beautiful. That's Roosevelt. So from time to time, he had these oratorical gems. But I think the position is that the speeches were basically hers. And I utilized Rosenman's oral biography to suggest that oftentimes speechwriters did make policies, sure. oftentimes Roosevelt said, I have to have a speech, please write a speech for me. Okay, but Roosevelt would look over it, and Roosevelt pointed out that Roosevelt oftentimes changed, didn't like it, told them he didn't like it, made emendations so that they were his.
General Distin?
Recently and currently, we've heard a great deal about debates, which, in my opinion, are largely question and answer sessions rather than debates. But in Roosevelt's time, did he, I've never heard of any, did he have any debates? And if so, were any of them meaningful?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question. You know, that's like the soft White House reporter that asked the question the president likes. I agree totally with it. The debates are sort of a question and answer sham. As a matter of fact, I'm going to write a book coming out in Prager on the Dukakis-Bush debate, but that's beside the point. I think, actually, the Roosevelt campaign ran a better debate than we get today, because you do get an attack and defense. That's what debate is, really, his aggressive defense in the campaign. I mean, the issues do come out. I would go even further to suggest that the issues, I hope not to insult anyone, but if the debaters were left to go in a Lincoln-Douglas style, or at least maybe even Nixon-Kennedy style, let the two people go out, set the agenda, respond, attack, let them do that. But the news media interject. And I don't know what their particular expertise is, other than they make $1 million a year for reading the news, of deciding for us, the American people, what the issues are. I think if we let the, maybe you disagree with me, but I think if we let the candidates set the issues, and if it doesn't want to talk about somebody, and somebody wants to force the candidate to talk about somebody, well, that's, you know, that's fair game. So the debates, I think, are sham. They're not really debates. They suggest how you might perform in a press conference situation, which is important, but not a debate.
Howard Cromwell.
What influence, if any, do you think the post-review of these presidential speeches are affected by the electronic media like David Brinkley and George Will and Sam Donaldson?
Well, you're getting into an area that's really beyond my expertise to answer that. I think they do. I don't know how much. The interesting rhetorical problem that you come to is the Nixon situation, Nixon-Agnew, and particularly in the Roosevelt administration in 1936. He was attacking the economic royalists and the toy press, who supposedly didn't support them, and clearly they didn't. Yet it didn't matter, did it? He was overwhelmingly elected. And the Agnew situation in the Nixon administration, here the liberal press, the media was attacking him. And yet after the Vietnam speeches, the American people would call up and be in support of Nixon's policies. So I think there's an interesting quotation that I like to have, that I utilize, that newspaper editors like to think their newspapers and perhaps the TV have more influence than they do. But then that can only be carried so far, because obviously with the exit polls, it does suggest there's an influence. I just don't know.
Bill Wample.
I always thought that one of the most infuriating, and because it was so effective, speeches of FDR was the winking, blinking, and nod speech. Remember that one?
Yeah, well, yeah. The winking, blinking, and nod?
Winking, blinking,
no.
They were three real hardline Republican.
Martin Barton
senators.
Fish?
Mm-hmm. I've forgotten their real name.
Martin, Barton, and Fish.
He had the audience.
Yes, responding, yeah, right. I didn't remember Winkum, Blinkum, and Nod. I do remember Martin, Barton, and Fish. Yes. Well, yes, he did that. And then at Boston, the crowd was so attuned to it that he, Martin, Barton, and Fish. And then he even, in an impromptu, almost impromptu situation, he cued the audience a beautiful rhythm here, Martin, Barton, and Fish.
Did Inkies write that one?
I don't know. I don't know.
Well, I think we've opened up the subject. The way to explore it further is to buy the book.
Amen.
And I think you have some oh, yeah, review sheets, which I encouraged him to bring. If anyone is interested in our speaker's book and some of the reviews and comments about it and other things he's done, why, there are these sheets on the table. We hope you'll pick them up. Above all, we hope that the connections that have been made this morning, both the connection with an individual scholar at Washington and Lee, but also the connection with the institution, is one that we can carry further. We, after all, have a former president who was rather much a part of your institution, Edgar Shannon, who had expected to be with us this morning, but who I think is taken Mrs. Shannon to a new doctor that they have, and so we're sadly without him this morning. But I would hope that as you continue to pursue your interests and we ours, that the points of connection could be solidified, and we look forward to the next time you visit.
Thank you.